The Spectator magazine combines incisive political analysis with books and arts reviews of unrivaled authority. Subscribe today for just £12 and receive a 12-week subscription in print and online, plus a £20 Amazon gift voucher, absolutely free. Go to spectator.co.uk/voucher.
Hello and welcome to Coffee House Shots, the Spectator's daily politics podcast. I'm Isabel Hardman and I'm joined by Katie Balls and James Forsyth. Well, we've reached another milestone in the vaccination programme, Katie. Talk us through what's happened so far.
Yes, so I think if you're on Downing Street, you'll be enjoying the papers today. Lots of front pages ultimately saying, you know, good news, the vaccine rollout is now getting to the point where the over 70s are going to start to be approached about appointments. I think there is a growing sense, and it's something, as we've discussed on the podcast, there has been the point that ministers privately, I think, have been more optimistic than even publicly they have been. But I think that is now catching on to something, and we're seeing lots more in the papers about quite optimistic targets, whether or not they're official ones people want to say on the morning broadcast round or not, about how quickly this can go. I think before we get to that, it's probably just worth pointing out that there's always, you know, a bit of a catch or some concern. And although the over 70s are now being approached, we're hearing more and more about the postcode lottery. So some parts of the country which have been much quicker to get the vaccine out, and other parts where actually there are still, you know, some 90-year-olds who are yet to have it. So I think there's a few tweaks. It's interesting that we even had a cabinet minister, Therese Coffey, this morning on social media, effectively saying in her constituency she's had some problems and she's looking into it. So broad picture, you know, big picture, I think this is a good news story, but clearly if anything, there are going to be a few snags with it. I think that probably the most eye-catching story at the weekend was in the Sunday Telegraph, and that was the idea that we could actually have everyone in the UK of adult age offered a vaccine by the end of June. Dominic Raab, when asked about that when he was doing the morning round on Sunday, would not say that this was the target, that the official line is they're going to try and vaccinate everyone by September, but offer the first dose. But I think the fact that that is making its way out and you're hearing similar things, everyone else is, you know, hearing those noises, shows that there is potential for that. Obviously, it rests on a few things, but it goes back to that point, which is the government has such a reputation for over-promising and under-delivering. I think they're very keen to have the inverse of that when it comes to the vaccine programme. And I don't want to jinx it, but the early signs are this is a much more successful programme, I think, than Test and Trace ever was.
James, let's talk about Test and Trace. Why is the vaccination programme apparently working so much better than the allegedly world-beating Test and Trace programme?
Well, I mean, what Jeremy Hunt, the former Health Secretary and now Chair of the Health Select Committee, has argued is the vaccination, I mean, this analysis is correct. The vaccination programme is like known technology, if you see what I mean. The UK had never had a test and trace system before. And it was always obviously hubristic to claim that we were going to have a world-beating system when, if you look at places like South Korea and Taiwan, they'd had one in place post-SARS, whereas the UK was trying to invent one from scratch. Vaccination is something the UK knows how to do. It is something that the UK have three big structural advantages, I think, in this vaccination programme. The first is that, with the exception of Thailand, there's no population in the world more willing to be vaccinated with a COVID vaccine than the UK one. So if you look in France, one of their holdups is you have to get an appointment with a doctor before your vaccine, where you discuss the side effects, because they are so worried about anti-vax sentiment. You don't have that issue here to anywhere near the same extent, so you can get on with it. Secondly, we have a regulator-approved fridge-based vaccine in the Oxford AstraZeneca vaccine, and I mean that makes distribution a lot easier, and I mean that's one of the things that is allowing it to ramp up. I mean, that comes to the two and a half advantages, is that the UK has bid early on supply of vaccines, and so the UK has a decent supply of both Oxford and the Pfizer vaccine. The Oxford vaccine, though, is going to have to do quite more of a heavy lifting, because it looks like there are going to be delays in delivery of the Pfizer vaccine across Europe, because Pfizer are trying to reconfigure their production to increase, to meet demand, and that is going to lead to a temporary fall. So the UK's got a varied vaccine portfolio. I mean, I think the third thing is the NHS means that there is a national healthcare distributor that knows everyone's details, knows how to get in touch with people about appointments and the like, and so can crack on with it. And I think the interesting thing is this weekend's numbers suggest that the government is on course to hit 2 million vaccines a week. That is a really big uptick from where it was just a fortnight ago. And I think the question is, how fast can it carry on ramping up? You know, there's another 10 vaccine, mass vaccine distribution centres opening today, because that determines the answer to the question that you asked Katie, and Katie was discussing, which is, you know, is it June for vaccinating the whole population or September? And there's obviously a massive difference, not just in terms of people's lives and confidence in the government, but also economically, in the difference between a world in which everyone has had their first shot by June and a world in which everyone has had their first shot by September. Because if everyone has had their first shot by June, I think you would be looking at an explosion of pent-up demand for kind of social activities and the like this summer.
And yesterday we had Simon Stevens talking about the demand on the NHS at the moment. And June seems a long way off when we hear him listing some of the figures involved. Katie, are we expecting to get more restrictions on people's freedoms over the next couple of weeks?
So I think there was a decision made last week in Downing Street to hold off on new restrictions. We've seen new restrictions in Scotland in terms of, you know, small measures, but just tweaks to the current lockdown. So on click and collect, that's no longer something there. But I think in Westminster, the Prime Minister was quite keen to give this time to see if the data was going to show the lockdown as it was as being effective, even though I think Cabinet Ministers such as Matt Hancock, potentially Michael Gove, were more open to a tightening of measures. As things stand, I think we have learned in this pandemic you can never truly predict, and if the alarming data comes in, often decisions are made quite quickly. But I think the focus is actually more on messaging, advertising, tougher adverts, tougher messages about adhering to the current rules rather than bringing in new measures. And so far the data, which is like suggests broad brush cases are dropping a bit, I think is adding to a sense that they might not need to go all the way. But I think in terms of predicting if in, you know, 3 weeks we're going to have a limit in terms of, for example, exercising in another household, is all still potential. But I think that there is definitely a desire to try and keep that as a very last resort. While some say you would need that in terms of the rates, there is also a concern that actually if you make the rules too tough, you lose enough people in terms of people who stop adhering to the rules, though those people who do then adhere to the tighter rules, you don't necessarily get that much of a gain. And that's just one argument, for example, I've heard within government.
And James, there's a lot of political energy being expended at the moment on the row over universal credit as well. So it's not just COVID restrictions that the cabinet ministers are anxious about. There is a split in the cabinet over the £20 uplift in universal credit, which Rishi Sunak wants to end, but Work and Pensions Secretary Therese Coffey does not want to end. And there are others in cabinet who agree with her. We've got an opposition debate this afternoon from Labour on the matter. Is the government handling this well so far?
I think what is difficult for the government is this question about, you know, is this increase going to become permanent or not? It was a temporary measure, the uplift, for the length of the pandemic. And lots of people say, look, that should clearly continue because the pandemic, certainly in terms of the economic effects of it, is nowhere near over. I think what the Treasury worry about is that if you continue this temporary measure for another year, it becomes permanent. It will be very hard to reverse. And so the Treasury wants to send people money, you know, £500, rather than continuing the uplift. I mean, the argument about that is that that £500 wouldn't capture people who lost their jobs as businesses reopened, but then basically realised that they weren't viable because consumer behaviour had changed so much during the various lockdowns. This is going to be one of the difficult things for the government, which is, how do you balance the desire for kind of retrenchment post-COVID when you consider how much money the government has spent and the increase in the national debt against the kind of political sensitivities involved? And I think you saw that in the weekend papers, which is you've had people decrying the idea of property taxes. You've had the idea of people objecting to the idea of higher rates of corporation tax, saying that's the wrong signal to send post-Brexit. And you've had people saying, look, no, you can't unroll this temporary increase in universal credit. You've had Stephen Crabbe, the former Work and Pensions Secretary, being very vocal on this point. The Northern Research Group of Tory MPs that tend to represent those Tory MPs in seats that were won from Labour for the first time at the last election, saying the same. You've got to keep this uplift in place. And I think this is going to be one of the political challenges for the government afterwards, which is all the hard choices are coming fast towards them on the economy and what they do. And what positions do they want to take? And I think what makes it particularly tricky is, at the moment, it seems that the markets are quite relaxed about the sheer amount of money that the government is borrowing. I mean, the Treasury's worry, and as Rishi Sunak said in his interview with Katie and Fraser for the Christmas issue, is that, the markets are very relaxed about these things until they're not. And you don't want to put yourself in a position where you're vulnerable, that a very small shift in the interest you're having to pay on your debt puts a big hole in the public finances. And so I think the kind of Treasury view is you need to take some tough measures to reassure the markets now. But when the markets are as compliant as they currently are, as kind of currently relaxed as they are about government borrowing, it is quite hard to make that political argument.
Yes, I was really struck when we spoke to the Chancellor just before Christmas, how he was so clear that he is concerned about interest rates and the fact they could change. I think it goes against some of the, I suppose, economic conventional wisdom on this. And it puts him in a group where it's not where lots of Tory MPs are. And I think one of the big problems for the government is even if you do get to the point where you have a bulk of Tory MPs agreeing that you need to show some signs of fiscal restraint or fiscal responsibility, even if there's baby steps, I do not get a sense that there are a bulk of Tory MPs who agree where that should be. And you're looking at the universal credit uplift. I think it's really notable that quite a few of the MPs in the former Red Wall seats, now Blue Wall, feel very strongly about that, cost of living. But yet, you look at those other measures, and I think the Shire Tories have their minds elsewhere, that they're concerned about in terms of tax rises when there should be tax cuts. And I think that it's going to be difficult to A, get the party in a position where they're willing to make these difficult measures, but two, then get to a point where they agree on what they should be and who should really carry the burden.
Thank you, Katie, and thank you, James, and thank you for listening.